without further ado, we're here with Mark Gellert. How are you feeling, Mark?
Hey, how are you? Nice to see you guys, and thanks for having me on.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And you're down at Delray today, right?
That's right. We're in Delray Beach down in Florida, just getting some practice in before heading up to New York for the U.S. Open later on this week.
That's awesome. And I think we should probably mention who you're coaching up at the U.S. Open, right?
Well, if she wins, you can mention it. I'd rather you. Yeah, I'm coaching Magda Linette. She's from Poland. So we've been working together for about 5 years now. So it's been a while.
I think something that's interesting that people wonder about is how tennis players meet their coaches and the relationship that they develop there. How'd you meet Magda?
Good question. It's a slightly unusual, I would say less typical way that we met. We were actually both in China training. I was working at an academy there in Guangzhou. And she had also been practicing there for a long time. And she had a coach at the time, although we were all at the same academy. And we at a certain point with her previous coach, they felt like it was time for a change. And so they asked to try out with me. And that was kind of where we began our journey together. But we've been, about 5 years together now. So it's been a while, and hopefully we can keep going.
Wow. Does she has the highest ranking of any of the players you've worked with on the tour?
Yes, I would say as a coach, I was fortunate enough early in my career to be a hitting partner for Martina Hingis, although I take no credit for any of her results whatsoever. As a coach, this is definitely, we were able to get to 19 in the world about maybe a month or two ago. So we're sitting at about 23 right now.
Wow, that's awesome. And where was she when you started with her?
One thing that you have to give Magda big credit for, she's been top 100 in the world for 8 consecutive years now. She has never dropped out of 100. So that's a pretty impressive achievement. And that was obviously way before I started. So she's always been in that sort of, I would say when we started, she was in that 70, 80, maybe she got down to 90 for a short period, but she's always been around there. But we've never kind of, back in about 2020, 2019, we'd got up to about 33 in the rankings. And then COVID came, kind of derailed our progress like it did for everyone. And then we've just started to grind back at it again. And we had a good run this year at the start of the year to help the ranking.
Wow. Is there anything in particular that you've been able to do with her in these last 5 years or so to get her rankings really up into that like top 20 area? Because that's a big, big jump. But being in the top 100 is obviously great regardless.
Yeah, I think that when to get to the ranking that we've got to, you had to at some point do well in a big event, because the points are so weighted. So, you can go out and win those 250 events, but you're only picking up 280 points. When she did this year in Australia, she made semifinals of the Open and picked up 780 points. And that was right away a huge jump up the rankings. I think for junior players as well, so much of your potential or your success will come from how well you schedule. Because so many times I see players making poor decisions with their tournament scheduling, their off-season training. That's why it's so important that you have a coach that's experienced and can guide you in that stuff, because it's really vital.
Oh, 100%. I think that that's a hot topic that we'll talk about on this podcast a lot, and it's just very prevalent in junior tennis, is choosing a coach for your kid and how that relationship will impact their career ultimately long term. You have any advice for players, for coaches, for parents that are trying to find that relationship?
I think that, coaching is such an individual thing, because what works for one person doesn't work for another. I always tell people, when you're looking for a coach, first of all, try to find someone that's qualified, okay, certified, done some basic qualifications. That doesn't mean that you're going to be a good coach. There's plenty of qualified bad coaches, and there's plenty of really good unqualified great coaches. Check out their experience, get on the court with a coach, a potential coach, and spend some time getting to know them before you make any long-term commitments, because so much of the relationship is knowing that person. And actually, one thing we do, I have my company, First Strike Tennis, we do a lot of help trying to get players that don't know. Tennis is such a complex sport because there's so many, it's so dynamic, there's so many moving parts. You need a team around you, from a fitness trainer, psychologist, training base, coach, someone that can take care of your management side, You know, even just down to racket customization, as you guys know at Diadem, how important that is. So you need to find sort of somebody that you trust. And that's where some management agencies are doing that for players nowadays, whether it's IMG or Octagon, etc. But I think that when you look for a coach, probably the best thing to do is word of mouth still, or finding someone like what we do, where we have access to good coaches that have experience and success.
Oh, I think that that's a great point there when you mentioned getting on the court with the coach and actually, you know, going through what that would look like when they're training you every day. So I think that's a cool spot. Is there anything in particular that you think people should really look out for when they get on the court with a coach that they're trying to feel out?
I think for me, some of the best coaches are the lowest profile coaches that, you know, they don't have a big ego. So the ones that are telling you how many top 20 players they've worked with or how many Grand Slams they've won, I would probably stay away from those guys in general. And there's plenty of those in South Florida, as you probably know. I would always be looking to sort of get a couple of references. You know, it's a great question, but it's not one I'm asked a lot, because there is no typical orthodox way to get to a coach. Some coaches like myself got in as a hitting partner when we were younger and then got into the coaching world that way, or as an academy. I think academies are great places to pick up coaches. And like I said, if you're already a successful player, then you have access to IMG, and then they have their list of coaches or Octagon and things like that. But I think it's a really, really big problem we have in tennis is the coaching level overall. So I think it's not an easy answer for that.
Yeah, it's like I mentioned earlier, very complex situation that's weighing on the minds of a lot of people out there. So I think it's cool to hear your insight on that. And a little bit earlier too, you mentioned that one of the big breakthroughs that Magda had this year was making it pretty deep in Australia. What kind of things are you talking to her about before those type of big on that grand stage? Because like you said, it's very important for her to get those big wins so you can get more points and everything. But how do you help her get in a better spot there to perform?
I'd like to say that I had a very big inspirational speech before each match, but I really didn't. It was, the work had been done, and in the off season at the end of 2022, I could see she was doing some good things. I knew we were trending in the right direction. And in the off season, we changed up our off season this year. We went from doing two sessions a day to one. So instead of sort of 4 hours on the court, we went down to one session of about 2.5 hours and then did a lot of fitness. So we changed it up a little bit. So for the first time when we arrived in Australia, she arrived fresh, not burnt out physically, but also excited to play mentally. There was that excitement of wanting to compete, rather than in the past, I think we've overworked her. She's got to Australia almost tired. Whereas here, she got to Australia fresh. She was excited and eager to play. And the work had been done. So, you know, before each match, there's a few reminders about the player. For example, first round, Maya Sheriff, we're playing. We didn't start very good. I think we were down 4-2 with a break pretty quick. And got some rain, but it didn't come off court, but we had a chance to talk to her. With the new rules and just kind of settle down a little bit and kind of encourage her to trust her own instincts, because that's what you want, right? As a coach, we want to be able to teach automation and adaptability. And that's the two things that I think we've done a good job with. So once we got to Australia, it was really a matter of just letting her play and staying out of the way, if anything. I think a good coach knows when to say stuff and when to shut their mouth as well and let the player just run with it.
That's really interesting and cool to see that lowering the volume and some of those things really helped her out there. The quote that you had there, I should have wrote it down when you said it. You said react. What are the two things that you're looking for as a coach?
Automation is one, or sort of repeatability, I would say. So you're looking to that point where you watch Novak Djokovic. He's not thinking about how to hit his forehand cross court. It's automatic. But what you also want now, which is a more modern way of thinking, is it's called a CLA, constraints-led approach to coaching, is that you want to be able to teach adaptability. That's a big part now. So, for example, the old days, we would feed a basket of balls and have them hit 100 balls cross court. But there's that, and that would help with the automation part, but it doesn't help the adaptability part. If a ball's higher or lower, faster or slower, deeper or shorter, we want to be able. So many times now we might do practices where Magda has her left arm behind her back for 5 minutes, or her left eye closed, or listening to music, or using a different racket, or just doing as many different things as we can is to disrupt her normal patterns, because then she can create repeatability and adaptability. For example, one thing that's quite interesting is I did some studies on Federer's serve and where his ball tosses. And we're always telling our junior players, and to those of you listening, that we want the toss in the same place. The reality is your toss is never going to be in the same place. It doesn't matter what your level. Roger Federer had, I think, 6 to 8 inch difference in the line of where he tossed the ball. He cannot put it in the same place. It's not possible. So what you have to do is be able to adapt your swing slightly each time to the toss you get. So you're never going to have the same one. So being able to be adaptable is really important in the modern game.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with that. And it's really cool to hear some of the stories that you just mentioned when working with Magda on the little drills and things that you would do to work on that adaptability. I think a lot of juniors out there kind of hear those stories and might try out, you know, playing with a arm behind their back or something like that. But I think understanding that the pros are out there doing those sort of things to work on that part of their game is really important for them, right?
100%. And I think, you know, nowadays, especially young people that are listening, you guys love video. You love being on the phone. Spend some of that time watching yourself or others play. You know, so one of the things we'll do now with Magda is when she's playing practices. Okay, so in tennis, you sit down on every two games. So we're going to say, as soon as she sits down, I want to hear her say one thing that she can tell me about the last two games. Okay, so it might be, I'm really struggling because I'm not putting any first serves in. Okay, fine. Now the second thing I want her to say is what she's going to do for the next two games. And there was, I don't know how true it is, but it was always a story of Nadal when he sat down, he has two bottles, one with his recovery drink in it, electrolytes, and one that was water. And the first one he would drink would be his electrolyte one. And during that time, he would process what had just happened in the past two games. I missed too many serves. The guy's attacking my second serve. His backhand's better than his forehand, whatever it is. But he would summarize it. And then he would drink his water. And during that time, he would be thinking about what he now needs to do with that information the next two games. What's his plan of action? So I think that using video is a really effective way that players can learn.
Oh, 100%. And the best thing about that is everyone's walking around with an iPhone right here. You got a camera in your pocket, you know?
Most powerful tool in the world.
Oh, exactly. It's a computer. It can do it all.
Exactly.
I'm wondering a little bit from what you just talked about is how much of your work with your players is spent kind of analyzing past performance and making those types of notes, and how much of that is incorporated in the overall training?
Everything I do, I write out. I have a plan each day. Or usually it will start off with a macro plan for the year, and then a micro plan for a training block, and then a mesocycle plan for the shorter day-to-day situations. So I always keep track of everything. I do a lot of video with Dartfish where we'll get her matches tagged and watched. So that's something. So I like to have a lot of scientific-based information and then put it into a plan. But like I said, it's not, there's so much of the coaching is about knowing the player. It was interesting last year, we had some help from a coach, Ian Hughes, who's been working with Magda and I helping the last year. And when he first started with us, he asked her for some information. It was a sort of a trick, really. He said, so can you tell me how do I get to Starbucks? And as he asked her this question, she went, okay, so go down there, make a right, go forwards, go left, and then it's straight on the right-hand side. And I hope that people can see the video right now, but what was interesting was she verbally said the instructions, but also used her hands to signal what he should do. So right away, he's gone, okay, Magda is verbal, but she's more of a visual person. Because when she went to tell you how to do it, to get to her destination, she did it with her hands. So that would be a big indication right there that this person is going to learn visually. So video, demonstrations, observation and imitation will be better than explaining to her and talking to her. And so these little things like this are really important. So when we're coming up with our plans, we always try to incorporate what we want, but we have to fit it in a way that suits her personality.
Wow, that's one of the more interesting little tactics I've heard a coach use to figure out the, like, really ultimately the learning style of their player, and that helps you connect with them better, get better results. So that's pretty cool to hear.
Yeah, I think coaching is such a unique sport. You need to know they're a visual learner, a verbal learner. Are they right eye dominant, left eye dominant, left foot dominant, right foot dominant, right hand dominant, left hand dominant? Are they somebody that needs calmness because they're kind of a more anxious person? Are they someone that needs a little bit more of a fire under them? Are they somebody that likes feedback during practice? So if we're in practice, plan a practice set, and she misses a couple of shots, does she want feedback right away? Or do we wait till the changeover? Or do we wait till the end of the set? What's the best way to do it? It's been interesting. One thing I've found with the juniors especially is sometimes the level increases. If I just hold my phone up and tell them I'm going to record a couple of points, the quality of the play goes up right away. Even if I haven't turned the camera on, I'm just holding the phone up and they think I am. So many things can affect the player, and you have to, that's why being together with one coach, which I try to encourage a lot of players to do, is stay with a coach that you trust in, because it's better, even if they're wrong on some things or they're not the most knowledgeable in something, it's better that you stay with somebody that you know and they know you.
And I think that that is a great point. And I imagine for some of the juniors, they look out at the pro players right now and in the modern era where they're kind of switching coaches a lot. You see that happening. What's kind of your opinion on what's happening in pro tennis with that sort of atmosphere going around?
I don't think it's changed. I think that it's been like that since as long as I can remember. I think in about 10 years ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that the average life expectancy for a coach on the tour is, I think, less than 4 months.
Oh, wow.
So it's not, I wouldn't say it's changed a lot. I think it's down to a number, there's a multitude of reasons why that happens. One being, I think it's an unusual dynamic, right? Where most people in a job are paid by the boss, and the boss tells them what to do. In tennis, the boss pays the coach and tells the coach then tells the boss what to do. So it's an unusual situation that doesn't exist. If you're playing for a football team or a soccer team, whatever, basketball, the boss is paid and he tells you what to do. But here Magda pays me and then I tell her what to do. So it's an unusual dynamic that can put a lot of strain on the relationship, which is why trust and loyalty is really important. I think there's also a problem with the quality of coaching. Available is not high. There's just not a good enough stable of coaching. And I hate to say this, but the States is particularly poor, because in other countries, for example, in England, we have the LTA, or in Australia, Tennis Australia, the governing body, which is the LTA in England, also is in charge of the certification qualification process. Okay. Same in Australia, the AIS is also in charge of their qualifications for coaches. In America, the USTA doesn't do that. They outsource their qualifications to the PTR, USPTR, or USPTA, sorry. So it's not as well organized as it should be. And if you look at countries like the Czech Republic, who just seem to create endless amounts of players with a relatively small budget, they don't have a Grand Slam that supports their tennis infrastructure like America does or England. So I think a lot of it's cultural, and there's a lot of weaknesses here, things I would change if I was in charge. I don't see that. I don't see anyone putting me in charge soon, but it would definitely be something I would want to address.
No, I see it all the time. It's like the Wild West out here for American junior tennis and the coaching and everything. So I think it's great that people are able to listen to things like this and get some different perspectives from other coaches. What do you think is a good indicator, or, if you're working with a coach for some time, when, and you feel like you need to break it off, or is there anything that like is, or signs that you can look for that you're not getting the results that you need from your coach?
It's a good question.
For the juniors mostly,
The juniors, this is my experience in South Florida with juniors. People tend to look for something that doesn't exist. And tennis is not a linear progression sport. It's not so much as I would imagine being an Olympic sprinter, where you do the right training and you eat the right food and you work a certain amount, you're going to naturally run that time down from 11 seconds to 10.8 to 10.5 to 10. And it doesn't always work like that in tennis, because the clock is objective in a sprint, but you have an opponent on the other side of the court. So I think that I've always encouraged junior players to find someone they like and stick to the process and be accountable, because there's too much here. It's a little bit musical chairs. So you see for 1 or 2 years, there's one coach or one academy that's really hot, whether it's Rick Macy or Nick Saviano or wherever it is. And then the next year it's gone somewhere else. So all those players have moved over. There is no magic formula. You want my overnight success or Magda's overnight success took 20 years. There's no such thing as a quick fix. What you want is you want someone in your corner that has some proven results, has knowledge, has experience, and number one, cares. That's the most important.
I think that's very insightful, and hopefully everyone listening to this runs that one back and plays it again, because I really do think that one of the bigger problems is sweeping junior tennis is just there's so much pressure on players, and if they don't get immediate results, it's really kind of a cultural thing with kids these age. If they don't see those immediate results, they want to move on. So I think it's important to trust that process, like you mentioned, and work towards something bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, as a coach, from a coaching side, I learned the hard way that the player has to know that you care before they care what you know. And that's a really important sort of maxim that I keep in my mind all the time.
That's a great quote. And then I'd love to hear a little bit about, obviously you didn't play junior tennis in America, but you did come and play college here. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, I'm from London, so I grew up in England playing tennis, and always dreamed, like most people do, to be number one and win Wimbledon. But once I got to about 16, I sort of figured that was probably not going to happen. So got some opportunities and came over and played college tennis 1 year at East Carolina for the Pirates. And then the rest I transferred down to South Alabama and played for the Jags for 3 years, which was a great experience. And I think it's probably, I would advise 99.9% of players to go that route, unless financially you're in a situation where you don't need any assistance at all. College tennis is a fantastic opportunity to develop your game, get the education, because the reality is if you're not in the top 100 in the world, you're not making a living. And it's not a fun life. It's not a glamorous life. Magda's 19 in the world. She has no sponsors. She has no support from any federation. It's all down to her. So if she loses, she's still got to pay the bills. She's still got, you know, all these kinds of expenses. So it's not a fun, easy life. There's a lot of upside to it, 100%. But it's definitely college is the way to go for most people.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty cool thing that I'd love to pause on and talk a little bit more about is the reality of pro tennis, because I think that's kind of something that a lot of those college age juniors that are kind of have the ability to potentially play on the pro tour right away might not really understand is what that the tour is actually like for a player. Even like you mentioned, Magda's ranked in right around number 20 right now, and she's not, you know, rolling in it by any means, you know.
100%. It's the reality is it's a lot of airports, a lot of airport food, a lot of hotel rooms late at night. We've had a great year this year. It's been her best year by far, but every single week we lost that we played. Every single week. So, you know, in South Florida here, when I hear these kids or the parents complaining that their son or daughter lost, well, guess what? We're 19 in the world, or 23 right now. We've lost every single week we played this year. Every single week. We did not win one tournament. So it's a little bit about putting in some perspective into what you're doing. And I always think that a good coach here also has to make sure that the parents stay involved in the process. I think one thing I would always be aware of is that a coach that tries to cut the parents out. I think that's a big mistake. I don't think it's the right thing to do, because no one's going to care for the player more than the parents. They might not always be objective, and they might not always be rational, but that's where the coach has to educate both parties, the player and the parents. So it's a process that you both have to go on together. But the reality of professional sports is not what it looks like on TV. That nice week that we'll be next week in US Open will be fantastic, but it's chaotic, it's stressful, it's not fun. After Australia, people said to me, they said, "Mark, wow, you must be so happy. It must have been an amazing experience." And I said, "Well, yeah, it was amazing, but I didn't enjoy any of it. It was highly stressful and demanding, and you don't get back to the room till maybe 12 o'clock midnight, and then you're up the next morning for practice on the day off between matches, and then you're at it again the next day. So it's not a fun job
in that respect." And then talk about the difference that is compared to college tennis and what the college tennis atmosphere is like for a player.
Well, I think the camaraderie that you get in the college system is second to none. And I think that's why I encourage everybody to go down that route, because you get an opportunity to play for yourself, for your teammates, for a coach, and for the university. And no way that I was in a financial position where I could have afforded to have training every day, equipment, coaching, fitness training. We had psychologists, we had massage therapists once a week. We had training room. You know, it's such an amazing experience, and it's kind of humbling. So I really think that junior players should always have one eye on that being the target. And if something else comes along, that's great. But, you know, we're seeing some junior players do well in college. And then, you know, Ben Shelton right now is obviously doing well. So although I do think once you go to college, your chance to play professional tennis after that does diminish. But the reality is that the cream rises to the top. So if you're good enough, you'll find a way anyway.
Yeah, I think that's always my point, is that if you're good enough, you're going to get there. And the, like you mentioned, the atmosphere, playing college tennis, being a part of a team is, I think, really special and something that will help players their whole life beyond tennis.
I mean, the friendships you make, the memories you have from college, they are the best times of your life. And I remember the coach telling us that when we were in college, and you don't listen to them at the time, because you think you know better and you can't wait to get out and make money and all that stuff. But I just think that I advise players to really start making sure they're taking care of all those things, which is, again, why you need to have somebody that's very knowledgeable, whether it's a coach or an agent, or not. It doesn't have to be a professional agent, but somebody that can be in the advisory business of making sure you stay eligible. You do the right stuff with your exams, visas if you're foreign are all in place. You're getting your, you know, UTR now is becoming a really big baseline measurement for a player's ability in college, your ITF ranking, etc. So making sure your ducks are in order is really important.
Yeah, 100%. And I wonder, someone too, especially from your background coming in as an international player, I imagine that process, making sure your ducks in a row, is a little bit more strenuous. How is that transition for you coming over from London to really North Carolina first and then to Alabama, which I imagine is a little bit of a culture shock?
Yeah, Alabama was, I mean, I really enjoyed it, but it was, I think the first question, or the most common question I was asked, was the conversation would typically go like this: where y'all from? And I would say, from England. They'd look at me and say, "Wow, can you say something in French?" And I'd say, "Well, why would I know how to say something in French? Oh, do you not speak French there? You don't know the Queen?" I said, "No, I'm not on first name basis with her yet." So it was definitely a culture shock for me, and it was probably a bigger culture shock for them. So, but it was, I mean, the best years of my life. I'm so grateful for the opportunity that I got here.
That's awesome. And then obviously you played a little bit after college before you really got into coaching, seems like full time, right?
I think you're being quite generous by saying that. I think, I remember I'd given myself 6 months after college. I worked during college as well to make some money, so I could play for about 6 months. And I think I went for three tournaments in Austria and Germany. And I think I lost first round in all three, and said to my, every match I said to my friend, that guy's unbelievable. He's going to win the tournament. And then he lost the next round of qualies. And I said, you know what? This is not, I'm not good enough for this. So I saved my money, quickly said, that's enough of that, and got into the coaching side, which has been, I've been really lucky because I love doing what I do.
What is it that drew you to coaching? Because I imagine that during that little stint that you had there, you may not have fully known, all right, I'm going to lock in on coaching after this, because the door is still open for anything. What drew you there?
For me, it was really difficult to turn my back on tennis. It had been such a big part of my life for so long, since I was probably 7 years old when I really got going. It had been what I did every day, and I couldn't just walk away from it. And I liked the game. I liked being involved in it. And I said, well, this is the way if I'm going to stay involved, it needs to be in coaching. I think I have some qualities that can make me a good coach. So I want to get involved with that. And I got very lucky early on to be assistant coach at the University of South Alabama, where I played for one semester for the women's team. Got me a taster of what it was like to sort of be in that position. And just transitioned into becoming a hitting partner, and then working at an academy down here in South Florida, which is now called Pro World, but used to be called International Tennis Academy in Delray. So it's a great, great facility over there. And just got into it that way and kind of been very fortunate since.
So it seems like you're the type of guy that is really a student of the game and constantly learning. What was kind of the process? Did you start right out of the gate as a strong coach, or what was that transition like going to the other side of the game, really?
Yeah, I think I came in probably too strong at the start. I wanted to be respected. I wanted people to know, because I worked hard, so I expected them to work hard. And I think sometimes I learned as a coach, you can't back yourself into a corner too quickly, because if you make a threat, you got to follow through. If you make a promise, you got to follow through. So, you know, I had to learn a few times the hard way that you have to be careful. But for me, it's a constant learning. I don't think I've had a day since I got into coaching where I haven't added to my, I would say, my Bible of information. I write down everything I do. I catalog it, because at any moment I know I can look back on that and say, I remember what I did this time when Magda couldn't hit her forehand well. This is what I did to change. Or when we were struggling, you know, off the court, creating a connection, this is what I would do. I always like to be very studious, and I like to get qualifications. And you know, for any coaches that are listening, I really encourage them to go out there and take. I became certified with the NSCA, with the CSCS, which is a kind of a high strength and conditioning program. Which, because if you're going to be a coach, you want to be as knowledgeable as you can in a variety of areas, whether it's a strength and conditioning, the mental part, racket customization, what you guys do down there. So, you know, it's as a coach, you want to be sort of the architect, I would say, of the project, and be able to advise your player on the best management company or the best tournament scheduling. They're in Europe practicing for 3 months. Where should they base themselves? All of this stuff is what I don't think is available to players very readily. And I do think that's where the federations of a lot of countries, including the States, fail their players, because what I think is lacking is a one-stop shop for all of those needs. And that's what I've tried to do with First Strike Tennis, is trying to create some kind of hub of information, because tennis is a very discombobulated, right? We have the WTA for the women. Then you have the ATP for the men. Then you have the ITF for the Davis Cup or Billie Jean King Cup and the Grand Slams. And then every country has their own federation. And then you have Tennis Europe. And then you have college. So there's so many different places, and you can't be well-versed on all of them. You need advice. And that's where, you know, coming from England, one of the things that was really tough was we had no idea of how a college worked. I didn't know, as bad as it is to say, I didn't know where Alabama was. You could have told me it was next to California. I wouldn't have known any different. It was, the reality was, is I didn't know where I would, you know, where was good weather, where was bad weather, which teams are good, which teams are bad, what are you looking for? So there were so many variables there that were really difficult to navigate, which is why I think, you know, I'm very empathetic to the foreigners as well coming in. But, you know, the Americans, it's very tough, because for you guys, it seems that the best American juniors typically go to maybe 10, 15 schools. and then, you know, the rest of the Americans have to slot in at other places where there's availability. Whereas the foreigners, we can come in and, you know, sometimes we can fit in all the places because of, you know, maybe we're very good in England, but we're actually not as good as the 10th ranked Floridian. But it's hard. So that is where UTR has been better at helping to level that playing field as well.
Oh, I think so. I can't imagine being a college coach today and having to weed through, and with all the players that are available internationally in the U.S. And like you mentioned, the 10th best player in Florida might be better than the best player in England that year, 100%. You know? So I think it's, and I think it creates a lot of pressure for the players too, to in the recruiting process, to feel like they are getting their name out there and all that kind of stuff. What was that like for you as an international player? How are you making those connections with college coaches?
So, I mean, they had a company back then. This was back in 2003. I started, so we probably started the process in 2002 with College Prospects of America was the company name, and they did college placement. And back then, probably people, the young guys listening right now and girls, won't even know what a VHS tape was. But it was a big, thick tape, and you would record yourself playing a match and get the company to make 25 of these videos and put them in an envelope and mail them to the States and then fax your information. So that was the process back then of getting in, which is also what I find even more impressive than, you know, I think what I did was challenging coming from a different country, but the amazing people to me are the ones that are coming from countries that don't speak English as their first language. I think that's the respect I have for that. Sitting in class in your first week as a freshman, at least I understood, you know, in economics, what the words that were being said. I might not have understood what he was talking about, but I understood the language. And that for me is incredible what those foreigners have done as well.
Oh yeah, it's unbelievable to see. I personally played with a guy from France and from Spain who had English as their second language, but still they're not completely fluent, and they're in there with some technical classes, you know, with crazy words that I grew up in America. I don't even know what they're talking about, and they have to follow along. So it's very impressive.
Very impressive what those guys do. Very impressive.
Really. Yeah, 100%. When you were getting into coaching, you obviously had some experience with college players, with juniors, with maybe some pros. When did you always know you wanted to go to the pro route and work with the best players in the world, or did you have to kind of feel that out?
You know, I think as a coach, the professional level is the pinnacle, right? That's the best players in the world. So you always think that that's a good option. But I knew that from a safety standpoint, college coaching is a great option, right? You're getting a nice salary, you're getting security, you're getting, you know, you don't have to travel as much. I think that one of the things people don't always realize with what we do is that it's 35 to 40 weeks a year on the road. That's a lot. You're not home very much. So it's mentally taxing. But college coaching was definitely interesting to me, and I really enjoyed working. I love working with the junior players because I think that that's where a lot of the foundations are laid. And if you don't do a good job at that younger age, too often you're going to see things, you know, some of the things that Magda struggles with are probably unfixable at this point because if they haven't been addressed very early in your career, some basic things. And that's why I also encourage a lot of players to do at a young age, do different sports. Or do tennis, but work in unstructured environments. I think a big problem in Florida now is my daughter or my son wants to play tennis. Okay, how many days a week can you give them a lesson? Well, as good as that is for my financial account, it's not always the best thing for the player because unstructured practices allow more exploration, experimentation, learning than structured practices. So it's really important as a junior player that you get out there and just, you know, screw around with your friends on the court there and play the mini touch games or serve and volley games and up and down stuff. So you're getting that opportunity to not always be in a structured environment.
I think that's a great tool that players can use is mixing in some of that unstructured stuff. Do you do that with your pro players or like the difference between how rigid it is for them versus, you know, some of that more exploratory stuff for a junior, or that you do them the same?
I think that it's you know, it, you know, years ago you used to base, when you would separate kids in lessons, you would base it on age. So you say, okay, that's the under 10 group. If you're 10 to 12, you go into this group. That changed. That's gone now. Now it's based on level. So you might have a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old in the same group. It doesn't matter because they're the same level. So the way I try to do it now is not look so much at their biological age, but look more at their skill set. Because what we're trying to do is improve skill acquisition. I think Magda would, if she was here, she'd probably argue and say we don't get to do enough of that, and I'm not giving her enough freedom on the court to do that. I do think that there's a difference as well in how you train females and males. If you look typically, women tend to prefer structured practices, and women and men prefer more unstructured practices. Men prefer more to sort of have that competition day to day. They're sort of what I would say more unconditional competitors. So no matter what's happened off the court, the fight they might have had with their parents or their girlfriend, they're usually going to still be able to practice, to train and compete unconditionally. Men like to get more in their comfort zone. Women tend to prefer getting more into their comfort zone during a practice. So there's a lot of different things. I think men, I've actually found that men, you have to drive more. The women, you have to lead them a little bit more. So there's a lot of differences in the way you would approach each of them. But I think the overall allowing kids, especially young ones, to spend time on a court without structure is really, really important.
I mean, I can't think of a better thing to do for a kid than to just let them go hit around, have some fun, especially if you have them on a, you know, a 5-day, 6-day, 7-day a week grind. That mixing in some of that stuff, it's not only good for to develop new skills, but also mentally. I think that something that the junior players that are listening in might be interested in is what the attitude that your pro players have when they're on the court in training sessions is. What is that like for them? What are they going in there? What are they looking for? What are they thinking? What are they trying to get out of it?
It's a good question. I think that the biggest thing that I've tried to, and it goes through phases, but I think that one thing that I really try to have as a philosophy is when you come on the court, you are there to get better, not to feel good. And that's a really big distinction. I think a lot of players come to practice, and I could give you a lesson and I could make you leave that court and feel like $1 million. Because if I do the right drills and the things you're good at and the things that make you comfortable, you will feel good. It's probably not a long-term strategy. Now, if it's the day before you're playing your first round of the US Open, that might be a great practice for you to have. But as a long-term idea, that's not going to be maintainable or sustainable, because we need to practice to get better, not to feel good. Ultimately, we've got to train in a way that you're able to handle adversity. So are you able in practices to handle adversity? So, you know, I like to do practices where I give her, like I said, okay, we're gonna play a set, but whenever I allow, you can steal a point from the other player, right? So you win the game, you break serve at 30-40, and I can call a mulligan on that. Okay, so the point goes back to 30-40, you got to do it again. Or I give you one new ball and three old balls in that practice set. I'm giving you things, I'm challenging you. Can you adapt? And these are the things I think that really important is trying to differentiate and separate the idea of practicing to feel good and practicing to get better.
I think that something that might be hard for players, like you mentioned, is getting out of their comfort zone and kind of trying to embrace that adversity instead of shy away from it. And I think you see that probably more with younger players than the pros.
Yeah, I think as well. I think, and it's a slightly more a differentiation between men and women, is when you're on the practice court, if you've ever taken the time, find it on YouTube or go watch Rafa in practice in real life, you will not see a player miss more than Rafa does. The guy in practice is just miss, miss, make, 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 miss, miss, miss. Why? Because during a practice for him, he's searching for his limits. So like a Formula One driver driving around a track, He wants to know in practice how fast can he drive around that corner, around that bend, before he loses control of the car, before he crashes. And he wants to get to the edge of the limit, because if he drives around it at 90, but he could have driven around it at 100 miles an hour, he's just lost an opportunity there to get into a first or second place rather than third or fourth. In a practice in the tennis court, a lot of times you see players hitting, okay, I want you to hit the ball down the middle, but the ball is always short. Or maybe it's comfort zone in terms of the speed of the ball and the spin. Spend your practices trying to get out of your comfort zone. Explore the edges of your ability and the limits. Don't, you know, when you get to the gym and you're lifting on the bench press, the guys now, the teenage kids, the men are always in there lifting as much as they can on the bench press, right? And they walk around with big pecs and they look great. But then do the same on the practice court. Come out there, and when you're hitting that ball down the middle, find your depth. How deep, how hard and fast can I swing to make that ball go in before I lose control? How deep can I get the ball before it starts to go out all the time? And that's what Rafa does. If you watch his practices, he gets that ball. He misses a lot, but he's finding the edge of his limits, so he knows where to bring it back to in a match. Whereas I think a lot of players in practice, they're staying inside their limits and inside their comfort zone. The match comes, maybe the player's a little bit, opponent's stronger. They have to find the edge of their limits, but they don't know where they are. So they miss and they're not comfortable.
I think that's a great analogy, looking at one of the best of all time and understanding that he's practicing to put himself in a position to play the best that he can. And the only way that he can do that is by testing and going as hard as he can and getting to those limits. So I think that's a great point. Another thing that you brought up briefly earlier with Magda was the idea that she hasn't won anything. You know, she loses all the time. And I think that's part of pushing yourself out of your comfort zone in your training, is also when you're going and playing competitive tournaments as a junior, understanding that only one person in the maybe 200 person, 180 person draw is going to win that thing. And trying to keep your head on and realize that just because you don't have the trophy at the end of the day, you still won, you know, you still have to win. You have that mindset, right?
100%. I think one of the challenging things for junior players and professional, but when you're junior, you do have less experience, understanding, and sometimes things, you lose that reality and perception. What's really hard in tennis, and I don't even think it exists in football or basketball, is because when you're playing in a team, your team can do really well and you look great, and they can do really bad and you can look bad. But with tennis, the unfortunate part is, or not the unfortunate, but the reality is, Magda has a measuring stick against her name every single week. Because every Monday morning, a new set of rankings comes out. Every week in Florida, there's a new ranking list of where you rank in the USTA's under 18 for Florida, or your, or whether it's your state or your, you know, the county, the city, whatever it is. So you're constantly having this number next to your name, and you have to separate, you know, if someone asks Magda, oh, you're a tennis player, her response would probably be no, I'm Magda Linette from Poland. I do play tennis, but I'm not a tennis player. And you have to separate the two, because you can't allow that number next to your name be connected to your identity. It's very important out there, because I remember as a junior player, my self-worth, my value, my confidence all depended on how well I was doing on a tennis court. And that's a mistake. You cannot allow the two to be connected. They're two separate things. You're not a tennis player. You're John, Steve, Sarah, Michelle, who is from wherever you're from, and you play tennis. You play tennis, but you're not just a tennis player. That's not your identity. So it's very hard. So if you ask Magda right now, well, okay, so how many times have you won a tournament this year? The answer is zero, but she's 19 in the world. And then you get into depth with, you discuss statistics with players. If you win 55% of points in a match, you're winning 6-3, 6-3, right? If it's incredible how much you lose. We've had several matches this year, and I wish I had them written with me right now, but several matches this year where we won the match, but won less points than the opponent. We had a match this year and we lost to Leila Fernandez. I believe, I need to double check on this, but I think that was the match, one of them, where we won more points. We won one more point than our opponent and lost 6-4 in the third. So, you know, there's so many parameters you can judge yourself by. The key to this, though, in my advice, is don't judge yourself on a ranking. Base yourself on standards, because expectations with Magda, she'll say, my expectation is I want to make the second week of US Open. That's her expectations. Okay, but we can't control expectations, because you could play the best match of your life on Monday or Tuesday, but the other girl happens to play the best match of hers as well, and you lose in a tight match. What you should be doing, guys, as a junior player, is controlling your standards. So when you come out, have you warmed up properly? Are you intense in the start of the practice? Are you giving as much as you can at the middle as the end, as you did at the beginning? Have your standards. I expect, or my standard is, I make 70% first serves, or my standard is that I practice this many hours a week, or whatever it is. Have your standards and don't allow those standards to drop, and good things will happen. But you can then take comfort and go out and lose a match and say, you know what? My standards are really high today. I did a really good job. I lost. So I'm disappointed I lost, but my standards were high. And that's fine, because if you keep standards high, I can control that, and we're going to manage this process all the way.
Yeah, I think that's great. There's really, really, that's the only way to survive years of playing tennis at a high level is to have that mentality. I think another thing too that I'm wondering if you kind of talk about with Magda or have with any of the players is looking at it kind of like big picture, long term. This is, if you lose maybe the first match at one tournament, that's not gonna be a dictator for what's gonna happen in 2 years when you're playing at Kalamazoo or at one of these national tournaments. So I think having a perspective long term too is helpful. Do you talk about that with your players at all?
Yeah, I mean, long term perspective is really important. I'm wrong so much of the time, but in the off season this year, I wrote down on her. So I make about a 6-page plan of what we're going to do in the off season, what the scheduling would be for this year's tournaments. And I wrote at the top of this one, and I genuinely meant it when I wrote it, was this will be the best year of your life, because I could see we were trending in the right direction. I saw all the little signs. Hadn't come together yet, but it was moving in the right direction, and I could see good things. You really have to, it is so cliche, but it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, and you have to look at the big picture, which is so hard. I struggle with it. It's a big weakness of mine, because you've flown 5,000 miles all the way to North Africa or wherever you've gone. You've played a tournament, you've lost 5 in the third, and you get on a plane, you come home, and it's hard. It's not easy. One of the things I encourage parents to do is always when you're, the drive home after a match is a really important time. And I always say to the parents, find 3 things that you can say positive about the match. And I had a parent, she said to me, I couldn't think of 3 things. There was only one. I said, fine, doesn't matter. Then say it freaking 3 times, right? Just find 3 positives, and then you can, that's a starting point. But so often, with Magda as well, it is important that you try to find what went well, because I can promise you that nobody's more disappointed with loss than she is. So me beating her up after that mentally is not going to help. It's find 3 positive things. And if you can't find one, and say it 3 times.
I like that. Say it 3 times. That's awesome. We are sadly running out of time here, but before we have to go, from what I've gathered talking to you today, over the body of your career, you've been able to pull a lot of tips and tricks and inspiration from other pro players, other coaches, it seems like. Is there any places or any videos, books, any coaches that juniors or parents or even younger coaches out there could go look at and kind of start diving into some of that stuff that you've been talking about today?
Yeah, I mean, I think for this, if you're looking for some great sort of, I would say the guru in the sport for us with regards to strength and condition and biomechanics would probably be Mark Kovacs, who has an institute up in Atlanta. He's really very well-renowned guy. So for anyone looking to sort of have a plan in place long-term, I think that would be a really good place to start. Online, I think that there's a lot of options. I think I would encourage all the every player really to, you know, you've got the classic books, Winning Ugly. I think Momentum, there's a book in tennis called Momentum, The Hidden Forces in Tennis, which is a really good one. And Carol Dweck has a really good book called Mindset, which I would encourage everyone to read. But I think that if you're really serious about your tennis and you're really looking for to maximize your potential, you need to have somebody in your corner that can advise you on all these things. Because if you're a parent or junior player, you cannot be expected to know all of this information. So I encourage them to utilize Diadem. You guys have so many resources now that you have connections. I'm over at First Strike Tennis. I encourage people, please, of course, to message us. If you have any questions, we're happy to help. But I think try to connect yourself and surround yourself with good people, which is easier said than done. But having a mentor, having a guide is really important, because I think the best example of this right now in our game is Alcaraz. You look at him and you say, you can clearly see when he's on the tour with his dad, is there sometimes, his brother was there yesterday, he's been raised well. This kid has great values. He works hard. He wins as well as he loses. You know, he really is a humble guy. He worked, and he's had Juan Carlos Ferreira in his camp for years. And he has entrusted his game to one person who has done a great job with him. And they win and lose together as a team. And I think that a lot of people should learn from that. I think that's a really successful, inspiring story of what we should be trying to emulate.
I think that looking at Alcaraz, there is a great person to check out because of everything you mentioned. But also, I feel like every time I go see an article about Alcaraz, it's talking about his physical abilities. It's talking about the type of person he is. It's talking about how he handled himself on the court and in critical moments, and not so much about his tennis. You know, people are more in awe about the person that he is and the competitor that he is. And it seems like a lot of that can be attributed to his team and having good mentorship.
Yeah, I think it was Novak said after the match at Wimbledon when he lost a few weeks ago, and they asked him how he felt with that. And he said, you know, it hurt, but I'd already got over that loss by the time I got home that night. And I think that's really important, because a lot of players don't, losing is a really great opportunity to learn. And if you're going to just sort of wallow in misery, you will miss that window of opportunity to learn. And Novak got really good, as did Roger and Rafa, at learning to lose and improve from those losses. So I think it's an important thing. And I think that's why Alcaraz is, I think tennis is in really good hands for the next 10, 15 years with him around.
I'm excited to watch it. And I know everyone here at Diadem is really thankful that you took an hour out of your life to talk to us. And hopefully everybody that watches, all the parents of junior players, all the junior players themselves and other coaches, are able to take some of what you said today and hopefully apply it to their programming and ultimately become the best that they can be, because that's what we're trying to do here.
I appreciate you having me, and happy to come on anytime. Thanks for everyone for listening to us, and please let me know if you have any questions, because I'm always happy to engage.
Appreciate that, Mark. And where can people reach out if they do have questions?
So we have our new website coming soon, firststriketennis.com. But for now, I don't know if you can put a link to my email address. It's just mark@markgellard.com. Pretty simple. Feel free to message me, and I'll be happy to help and advise. And thanks again to you guys at Diadem for giving me this platform.
Perfect. Thanks, Mark. And stay tuned, guys. Make sure you guys like, comment, share, subscribe, and we'll be back with more courtside sessions soon enough.